When it came to homelessness, this pandemic, it had lessons for us. The threat of COVID finally led the state and federal governments to do something I've been banging the table about for a long time. Treat an emergency like an emergency and offer a FEMA-level response. Instead of fighting over crumbs to implement different homelessness solutions, we suddenly had real resources and the alignment from federal to state to local governments to begin moving that needle. And so today I'm announcing that for the first time ever, with the new money our budget is investing, we will dedicate nearly $1 billion towards ending homelessness.
Mayor Eric Garcetti delivering his State of the City address yesterday. He detailed his spending plan for the next fiscal year, what he called the Justice Budget. It was formally unveiled today. It includes nearly $1 billion, as he says, to fight homelessness. And that money would go to renting, buying, and building more housing and funding programs to keep people from slipping into homelessness. The mayor also proposed a pilot program for a universal basic income. He wants to give some low-income families between $1 and $2,000 a month for a year with no strings attached. The whole proposal still needs approval from the city council. Garcetti's tone was a big reversal from last year when the city was projecting huge deficits at the beginning of the pandemic. Those deficits did not materialize, and that's thanks in large part to the stimulus package signed by President Biden earlier this year. But the mayor's budget also reflects the increasing pressure he's under to deliver on his years-long promise to stem the city's homelessness crisis. We're going to talk about this now with two people. The first, Anna Scott. She covers housing and homelessness for KCRW. Hi, Anna.
Hello, Madeline.
And also, Shayla Myers is senior attorney in the Housing and Communities Work Group at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. Hi, Shayla.
Hi, Madeline.
Anna, let's begin with you. This is a sounds like a big chunk of money from the city's budget, $1 billion. Where is the money coming from, and how does it compare to what the mayor and the city has spent in years past on homelessness?
Yes, it is a lot of money. You're definitely right about that. Garcetti said in that State of the City speech last night that when he became mayor, so that's 8 years ago, the city spent about $10 million on homelessness annually. And starting July 1st this year, that number will be $950 million. So huge for Los Angeles. It's also worth noting it's still less than half of what New York City spends in a year on homelessness. So I think that's a perspective that's good to throw in there. But it's a lot of money. It's going to go to a variety of efforts directly related to housing and homelessness. And so some of that money is accounted for in the city budget. A lot of it is spending that has been in the works on permanent supportive housing through Proposition HHH, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. And a lot of the money is also coming from one-time state and federal COVID relief funds.
Right. So the Biden administration allocated more than $1 billion to the city of Los Angeles. And so that's some of that money is coming from that.
Right. So some of that spending will go to homelessness.
Shayla, what's your reaction to the mayor's announcement?
I think there's no question that $1 billion is a lot of money to spend on homelessness. And my concern is that it's a lot of money to spend to support unhoused folks. And my concern is that a lot of that money isn't actually going to go to solve the homelessness crisis. The city of Los Angeles keeps spending money on addressing the visible signs of homelessness, investing in emergency shelters, those kinds of things, without investing money in deep ways to actually solve the housing crisis in this city.
Although we did pass these two initiatives that Anna mentioned, HHH, also Measure H, those were supposed to address the long-term homelessness problem. Have they not done that?
Absolutely. There's no question that investments like Proposition HHH are playing the long game, right? They are about investing in the needs of housing that we have in the city. My concern is about the other money, the money that's coming down from the federal government, where the city has, over the past few months, seemed to be suggesting that we need to be investing in right now rather than in the long term. And if we look back in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years at a moment when we had $1 billion invested in homelessness, and we spent that money not on solving the crisis, but rather on addressing homeless encampments rather than addressing the emergency needs. And we will be no better off. And we will say that 2021 was the year we wasted $1 billion.
Wow. Anna, do we have details as to exactly where this $1 billion is going?
We do. We have buckets. So a lot of it is going to go to permanent affordable housing, which is very key for looking long term. So the biggest piece of this spending pie, $350 million, is going to help fund new apartment buildings for people who were formerly homeless with subsidized rents and social services on site. That is from that bond measure, Prop HHH, that city voters passed almost 5 years ago now to pay for thousands of new apartments like this. Now, that has been very slow going to results from that bond measure. Right now, there's less than 1,000 units open, and that measure was supposed to add an additional 7,000 units ultimately to the city. So it has been slow moving, but Garcetti is saying that this coming budget year is when it's finally going to pick up steam, and they are actually going to spend a big chunk of that money and hopefully start construction or be close to starting construction on more than 5,000 of those promised units. So that's a huge chunk of this. There is also money that is going to go to more temporary solutions, things like shelters, homelessness prevention programs, like a legal fund for people facing eviction. Money is also going to go to street cleanups. And a chunk of it is going to go to a modest expansion of Project Room Key. That's the program that places medically vulnerable people experiencing homelessness in hotel rooms for the pandemic.
Shayla, what is your assessment of Project Room Key? Has it been successful, or do you think it's a failure?
I don't think it's been successful. You know, when Project Room Key was announced at the beginning of the pandemic, it carried a lot of promise of taking a resource that was available and bringing the most vulnerable inside in the middle of the pandemic. The reality is it simply has not played out like that. Many, many people have gone into Project Room Key, and like every other emergency shelter program in this city, there has been no path out of that emergency shelter and into permanent housing. For me and for lots of people looking at the program, it's a really good example of why this city needs permanent solutions to the housing crisis and not more emergency measures.
Right. And so you see what happens when, all that comes to a head in the sweep of Echo Park recently. And what happened to the residents who were told they couldn't live any longer in their tents along Echo Park Lake, Shayla?
There were a lot of people at Echo Park, and there are a lot of stories of what happened. So some transitioned into Project Room Key rooms in a stable location in downtown Los Angeles. We've heard stories of other folks who were transitioned into Project Room Key spaces that lasted a day or two and then were moved into other spaces and even more spaces. Others were promised and looked for those Project Room Key rooms, and they didn't come to fruition. Some people are still on the streets outside of Echo Park. You know, what happened in Echo Park Lake, again, is just a really good example of the city attempting to put a Band-Aid on a crisis without actually looking at the long-term solutions that we need. When you have that many people on the streets of Los Angeles, we need long-term solutions, not these temporary Band-Aids that are going to displace people from encampments and at the end of the day not give them a path forward into actual, true housing.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Anna mentioned, $350 million of this proposal that Garcetti announced yesterday would include permanent solutions, that money from Measure HHH. You don't think that's enough?
It's not that it's not enough, although at the end of the day, we know that the units that are being built with Project HHH are not going to be enough to solve this crisis. It's that we need different kinds of investments, and we need different kinds of policy solutions that will address the affordable housing crisis. You know, the State of the City address is about the long-term goals of the city. It's about the budget, yes, but it's also about the policy changes and the rethinking of a city's attitude about how it's going to solve a crisis.
Anna, how has the mayor changed in his approach to this crisis? I mean, you mentioned that there's significantly more money now being directed to this, but how have his priorities changed over those last 8 years, and especially since the pandemic?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that I can speak to his priorities, but I do think it's fair to say that as this crisis has gotten worse and worse and worse, and pressure has increased exponentially in recent years on all city officials, this has become a very front burner pressing issue. I mean, I wouldn't say that we've seen a complete transformation in their approach, but I also do think it's fair to say that that the emergency kind of short-term measures that they are taking now, that is something new. You know, I think that for a long time in homelessness policy, there was sort of this dichotomy between permanent supportive housing and emergency solutions. And I think the policymakers for a long time were exclusively very focused on permanent housing, even though in Los Angeles, we were not seeing a lot of it being built or created, which is a whole other issue. I think now, at least in terms of what they're saying, city officials are much more along the lines of, you know, we need it all. We need to do emergency short-term things to assist people right now. And then we need to also have those permanent solutions. But there's a lot of tensions there, you know, and as Shayla was just talking about, I think there's still a lot of anxiety that those short-term solutions can overshadow the long-term ones.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. It is between doing something to alleviate the crisis immediately and addressing the long-term problem, which, to be fair, wasn't just created under Garcetti's administration. This has been a decades-long situation, problem. I'm wondering, though, it does seem viscerally that the homeless situation has gotten a lot worse in the last year. Just driving along city streets, it just seems there are so many more encampments. Is that backed up by statistics? Do we know, Anna?
We don't know. You know, this year, Los Angeles City and County are not doing an official homeless count like they usually do because of the pandemic and safety concerns about sending out volunteers to do that. The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, the city-county agency that mostly deals with homelessness in LA, they did recently do a briefing where they shared some of their own analysis about what's going on. And it was honestly pretty ambiguous. Basically, what they said was, yes, we acknowledge that it appears that the crisis is getting worse, but we aren't sure if that's because there are more people on the streets or because the city and the county are abiding by CDC guidelines, or were for a long time, of allowing people in tents to shelter in place. That's less true now, but for a long time they were. So anyway, they were making the argument that it could just be that encampments have grown and become more visible because those sweeps weren't happening as regularly for a long time. So it's really hard to say. But absolutely, I think it's safe to say that a lot of people are being financially impacted by the pandemic. And there's a very high chance that a lot more people may be pushed to the brink of homelessness because of the pandemic.
Anna Scott covers housing and homelessness for KCRW. Shayla Myers is senior attorney in the Housing and Communities Work Group at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, Los Angeles and other California counties team up to sue drug makers for creating the opioid crisis. It's a landmark suit, and we'll talk about it next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The CDC says over the past two decades, 500,000 people have died from opioid overdoses. Of course, that does include illicit narcotics like heroin, but also prescription drugs like OxyContin. Now, three California counties, LA, Orange, and Santa Clara, up in the Bay Area, along with the city of Oakland, are suing a handful of pharmaceutical companies, saying they helped create the crisis by playing down the risks in order to increase sales. Here with more is our legal, Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor. Hello.
Hello. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday to you. So take me through the facts of the case here. Who is being sued and what is the main argument?
Yeah, there are four drug makers being sued, include Johnson & Johnson. These are big pharmaceutical drug makers, and they're being sued for the reason that you talked about a little bit just now, which is the idea that they engaged in either deceptive or false advertising in marketing practices that are so deceptive that they're in fact illegal, and that as part of those marketing practices, they were not only aggressive in saying you need this, but they really downplayed the potential addictive risk, and addictive means potential for overdose, potential for death. And that's what's being argued in this case and in a number of cases throughout the nation, the idea that those deceptive practices can be linked to deaths. And therefore, what the pharmaceutical companies created was something called a public nuisance, and they should be liable for that.
And what are the companies saying about that?
The companies are saying, no, actually, we didn't engage in false advertising. We told doctors about the risks. Doctors did not lie. People understood that there were potential issues of addiction. And you can't draw that line between what we said and what happened. They also said, you know, we're actually a pretty small part of the opioid market. We're not responsible for this health crisis. Don't try and tie us and our marketing practices to this health crisis. So they're trying to cut that causation line.
This sounds an awful lot like the litigation against the tobacco companies that occurred in the 1990s. And in those cases, I believe states settled, right? Or the companies settled, and the companies had to pay hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes, that's right. So I think that's a great analogy, actually. And it might be, you know, that we're talking about that level of settlement again. A settlement doesn't always necessarily mean that the company is admitting liability. What they are saying at a certain point is it's going to cost us X number of dollars to defend this suit, to litigate it. It'll cost us Y to just settle. And so we're engaging in a business judgment here to settle. The other thing is, you know, obviously in front of a jury, big pharmaceutical companies aren't always particularly sympathetic. So I think they understand the practicalities of these cases too. And again, a lot of cases, I think there are more than 3,000 pending lawsuits right now regarding opioid addiction, whether or not you can tie pharmaceutical companies to what happens as a result of opioid addiction.
Right. And I understand Purdue Pharma has actually declared bankruptcy to pay some of the liability costs associated with it.
Yeah, and we could obviously, you know, companies can avail themselves of the bankruptcy code, and then that gives them some protection, and it has creditors paid off in a very specific order according to the statute. So we could see that. I think a lot of people are going to be watching this particular case because it is going to trial to see what happens, what, you know, how many damages, if the damages are awarded, what's the level, and then a number of companies could make a calculation, decide whether or not to settle.
And would that settlement, would any of that money trickle down to the families who were actually affected, who had a family member who died, for instance, or would it just go to the counties for treatment and that kind of thing?
So my understanding is it depends on who the plaintiffs are. So in these particular cases, the plaintiffs are counties, and they're saying residents here were harmed, and that's why we have enough harm to come into state court. There could be other cases where you have private plaintiffs, and in those cases, the money would go more directly to the plaintiffs in those cases, and it would be more like I hate to use this as an example, but more like an airline crash case where the families of the victims sue and they say, this is how much we lost as a result. That would be slightly different than how these cases are styled, where it's a quote unquote public nuisance.
Boy, that term really seems to downplay the severity of the crisis, but I understand that's a legal term. Meanwhile, let's look at what happened at the Supreme Court this week. It took up a big immigration question yesterday, and looking at whether or not if you come into this country illegally, but you end up being part of a protected group, you can be deported. It appeared the justices were inclined to say no. And so tell us about this case. It involves a couple, a married couple from El Salvador.
Yeah, it involves this couple, and it brings up a question of statutory interpretation that when I say it, I understand everybody that it sounds kind of boring, but obviously it has huge implications. And it's important, I think, at the outset to say that this involves how we're going to interpret a statute, because whatever the court decides, it won't be a constitutional decision. So if people are unhappy with it, they can go to Congress and say, look, we need to allow people who are originally here in this country illegally, who are then granted temporary protected status, to be able to apply for green cards without first having to go home. And that's really the question in this case. Do you first have to go abroad and then apply to legally in the second instance, enter the country? And because the statute talks about granting green cards to people who are, quote, inspected and admitted. And the question is, if you originally arrive illegally, if you're then granted temporary status because of a humanitarian crisis in your own nation, do you have to go abroad first before you can have something called adjusted status, where you move from that temporary status to a green card status? And a lot of the arguments were really just about, what do we mean by that phrase? What do we mean by inspected and admitted? And as you said in the question, Madeline, it seems like a majority of the court said inspected and admitted does not include this class that has temporary protected status, which would mean practically that this group would have to go abroad and apply for legal entry before they could, as they're applying for their green cards. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it is called temporary protected status. And that is something that Justice Stephen Breyer pointed out. Let's listen to him.
I mean, you could say, you're here, Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, you came in absolutely illegally, absolutely wrong that you're here, but you're here. And if you're here, we're not going to ship you back to a place where you're really in danger. Okay? Well, you're in danger. But once that's over, goodbye.
Okay, so what do you think if the court does rule against the plaintiffs in this case, what do you think this will mean for the rest of the people who are here under TPS?
That is such a Breyer question, by the way, with this kind of long hypothetical leading up to, and therefore, X. So what does it mean? It would mean that this group of people, and I believe it includes about 400,000 people from 12 different countries, if they want green card status, would have to leave the country in order to apply for green card status. Otherwise, they would be under this temporary status. Now, that's option number one. Option number two is that's what the case says, but that's a temporary decision because there's enough people who go to Congress and say, you have to fix this language, that's not a long-term state of being for this particular group of, again, 400,000 people. We're talking about a huge group of people who live in our country. And I think what I heard from Justice Breyer also is a little bit of, you know, look, plaintiffs, if this is what you want, then ask the lawmakers to change their language. We're not always the place to help solve these very real problems.
Yeah, once again, it is up to Congress to actually make immigration laws. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular legal, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, actor Forrest Whitaker is here. He's on TV now playing a real-life Harlem crime boss named Bumpy Johnson.
He is able to do something that's never happened before, is to try to bring all the black dons of the country together, to like work all together to be able to be more successful.
Forrest Whitaker is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There wasn't offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Actor Forrest Whitaker is best known for his roles in big movies like Black Panther, Arrival, Star Wars, Rogue One. He's been in more than 75 movies and even won an Oscar for his role playing Ugandan dictator Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland.
I am a simple man, like you. I know who you are and everything that you are. I am you.
Well, now Forrest Whitaker is starring in a TV series. It's called The Godfather of Harlem, in which he plays a 60s-era crime boss named Bumpy Johnson.
You and me, we're more alike than you think. We're both visitors to this country. The only difference is you came here by choice. I'm a second-class citizen in my own country, and I gotta fight for what's mine.
Bumpy Johnson was a real man. In the TV series, he's joined by other real men of the era, Malcolm X and Congressman Adam Clayton Powell. Johnson's nemesis is the Italian crime boss, Vincent the Chin Gigante. Forrest Whitaker, welcome to Press Play.
That's great to be here.
Great to have you. Tell us more about Bumpy Johnson. I don't think he is a household name for a lot of people. Who was he in real life? Tell us more about him.
Bumpy Johnson was the crime boss that ran Harlem through decades up until the 60s. He's a chess player, he's a poet, he's a drug dealer and a murderer, and he's also a philanthropist who like helps his community. He's been working in his community to like uplift them, giving scholarships and different things of that nature. So it's a weird kind of dichotomy to him, because he walks a line that either you're going to accept or not.
Mm-hmm. So really an interesting, meaty character for you to delve into. Is that what attracted you to it, that he was such a complicated person?
Well, honestly, I mean, I was approached by Marquand Smith and Jim Acheson, and they came to me and they talked to me about whether I would want to develop something about Bumpy Johnson. But there had been a few things about Bumpy Johnson. Lawrence Fishburne had actually done a movie about Bumpy Johnson. But I decided that what was interesting was that we were going to be able to juxtapose, in this case, Bumpy Johnson against a certain time in his life, which was the 60s, which is like when the country was in a very volatile state, and we would be able to explore through dealing with his partnership, with his friendship with Malcolm X, with Nigel Thatch, and with Adam Clayton Powell, which I think was an interesting way to move into the time and the period while exploring a person trying to live during that time and excel during that time by any means that he had.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip of you with the Malcolm X character, Malcolm X played by Nigel Thatch, as you mentioned. And this is just when Bumpy Johnson is out of prison. He spent some time in Alcatraz and he's back in Harlem. It's been many years, about 10 years or so, and things have changed.
More heroin comes out of these project towers than any other place in Harlem.
Wouldn't like this when I went away.
Shutting down drug corners was the nation's cause.
I got guns. I got soldiers.
So they team up together to kick the Italian crime bosses out of that particular part of New York, of Harlem. And in real life, though, they were friends, right?
Yeah, they did. They knew each other. And, you know, Bumpy Johnson helped them with a number of different things. And I think it'd be kind of almost impossible to have been as large of a figure as he was in the community to not know people like Adam Clayton or Malcolm X. What you just showed us was when he first arrives back from prison, and now he's like all of his power, all of his things have been taken over by a lot of the Italian mob, and he's trying to reclaim that. And we watch him throughout that season reclaim that, and ultimately, unfortunately, he kills a main guy. That's when they put a 5-family sanction against his life. So when we come into the second season, he's been racing and running around, and he's been hiding and hiding in disguise, trying to figure out how he can get this sanction lifted off his head. And he realizes in this season, you'll see that the way you can do it is by controlling the dope from them and the connections that they have that are coming out of France, the French connection, and the Corsicans. Ultimately, the Corsicans want to work only with him if he has like a white partner. And he ends up for a brief while like partnering with Vincent the Chin Gigante, which Vincent D'Onofrio plays that character. And that doesn't work out. But he is able to do something that's never happened before, is to try to bring all the Black Dons of the country together, to like work all together to be able to be more successful. And we watch as that starts to try to happen and as it falls into place, and then what happens from all that.
It's interesting to see this perspective from, you know, the sort of Godfather genre told from a Black point of view. And why is it, do you think, that the sort of the Black Godfathers weren't as successful, if you will, as the Italian Godfathers?
He wasn't able to make the deals necessarily. He was being controlled by the time and the period of what was allowed. There's a scene in season two where he's talking to Robert Morgenthau, who's the head of FBI, who's like manipulating him and trying to control him. He says, you know, the fact that he had another choice, that my character has another choice. And I say, no, he didn't have another choice. And he says, I mean, Morgenthau says, well, I had a choice. I could have been that, but I wanted to be a lawyer. And I said, I wanted to be a lawyer too, but I put my application into State City College in New York and they wouldn't accept me, you know, because I was Black. So our choices aren't as parallel as you'd like to think.
Yeah, well, such a lot of rich material to discover. And as you say, a lot of it so relevant to today. And your next film is Respect, right? That's the next one to come out. Mm-hmm. And you play Aretha Franklin's father, C.L. Franklin, also a larger-than-life character with a complicated story. How did you approach his life? And how do you see him as a person, as a man? I mean, he's been portrayed as someone who is complicated in terms of how he shaped Aretha Franklin's career and how he pushed her to become a star. And also his personal life was very complicated. How did you see him? How did you view his character?
He's definitely a complicated individual. I mean, he was pushing, I guess, trying to work with his daughter because he felt she was destined for greatness. And she was like probably 9 and was on the road with her when she was 11. You know, in a lot of ways, she had to get away from the sort of pressure that he would put upon her and the requirements that he would have in the way she'd live her life. And that, like, sometimes resulted in negative things, early childhood pregnancy and alcohol issues and things of that nature. They were manifested partly out of that relationship. And there's all those things. But then at the same time, he was an amazing preacher, considered one of the most studied preachers, I think, in the entire country or world. And he had a particular style of hooping and stuff of preaching that was very unique, that he sort of perfected and that people follow and studied and learned how to do. He was great at telling stories as a theologian. He was also extremely deeply involved with the civil rights movement. It's one of his close friends was Martin Luther King. And actually the speech, I Have a Dream speech, was actually said first in Detroit in a march that was a precursor to the March on Washington. They had that kind of relationship, and that was part of him as well. So there's a lot of, as you say, different views on him, but he was certainly a very complicated man, a talented man, a brilliant person as well.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of people know that you studied opera at USC before you began studying acting. Do you still sing?
No, not much. Well, I did. I sang in this musical, that movie musical called Jingle Jangle. And that was kind of fun, you know, sort of, it's a magical movie and I loved working on it. It made me realize how much joy you get from just singing. I forgot how good it feels to like just be vibrating like that. It was nice.
Yeah. You've had such a prolific career. It's kind of dizzying to think of how many productions you've been in, movies and TV and all that. Do you ever think, okay, I think I'm going to slow down a little bit and maybe take a break, do something else?
Yeah, I think about it quite often. I was thinking about it the other day when I was talking to my manager, and they were talking about this part, and then they're saying that there's a window where you can direct before you do the other movie after that. And I was kind of like, look, guys, I can't just work all the time. I finished the show, and one day in between, and I was on the phone with the director of my next project. So I was kind of thinking, got to slow down, maybe do something else, relax.
So why don't you?
Well, I already committed to these couple movies. So, but I have responsibilities too. I mean, I have kids and families and stuff. I didn't progress to that sphere where I never have to work again. So my dad worked all the time. I guess, you know, he'd go to work like 5 days a week, hopefully relax on the weekend. Can't argue, he did it all his life. And so do most people in the country. So I guess there's nothing weird about it, just working.
Yeah, I guess so. What did your dad do?
My dad was an insurance man, and my mom was a teacher.
And you grew up here in LA?
I did. I grew up in Los Angeles, first in South Central, then in Carson. My family's still there. My mom, dad, my brothers and sisters.
But you're in New York?
I'm in New York now. I think I'm in New York. I guess I might as well soon be calling myself a New Yorker, since I, for the show for Godfather Harlem, I'll be here for at least 7 or so months out of every year. So what am I?
You'll always be an Angeleno.
Yeah, that's true. Probably.
Well, no, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
That's Forrest Whitaker. Godfather of Harlem, the show that he stars in, airs Sunday nights at 9 o'clock on Epix. And we have some breaking news for you now. A verdict has been reached in the Derek Chauvin trial, and the verdict is expected to be read between 1:30 and 2 o'clock our time. We will have live special coverage from NPR beginning at 1, so don't go anywhere for the very latest. Well, before that, coming up on this show, we'll have new music for a new season. DJ Aaron Bird is here with some recommendations for your playlist. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it's getting warmer. The days are getting longer. Spring really is in full effect. So this is a great time to check out some new music. And we have The Arbiter, KCRW DJ Aaron Bird. Hi.
Hey, Madeline. The Arbiter, huh? I haven't heard that one before. All right. I'll take it.
Well, you are now the Arbiter, Aaron the Arbiter. So first of all, I just want to let listeners know when they can hear you on the air, because of COVID, we have all these crazy schedules. So when are you DJing on KCRW?
Yeah, you're right. So most of us, with the exception of Novena and Anthony, we're alternating 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So you can catch myself and Travis every night from 8 to 11, 2 weeks at a time. Hopefully that's not confusing.
Okay. Right. It's not confusing. This week it's Travis. But in a couple of weeks, you'll be back on.
Exactly.
All right. So in the meantime, you have brought us 5 songs today. And we're going to begin with Sun Is Hot by Nala. She's a Miami turned LA artist. And before we hear a bit from Sun Is Hot, tell us about her and the song.
You know, she's a recent discovery, but this came across my airwaves, I should say, because she's a recent signee of Dirty Bird Records, who many of the listeners are probably familiar with. They're known for bass-heavy dance music. And this is a first release from her in a B-side. And immediately when I heard it, I just knew I had to have it and throw it on the airwaves.
I know, and it fits because it's called Sun Is Hot, and well, the sun is hot and it's getting hotter. Here is Sun Is Hot by Nala. Show.
I feel like you say that every time I'm on with you.
Okay, well, this song really is, well, it's perfect for now because we're all feeling like we want to shake off our pandemic constraints, right?
Absolutely.
We want to get on the dance floor.
Yeah, absolutely. It just makes you feel good. I feel like, and I challenge anyone who's listening to that music, whether or not you're a fan of house music at all, if you aren't feeling something, then you just might want to check your pulse.
Okay. Woo. All right. Let's move on to our next group. And this group is called Chawa.
You got it.
And we're going to hear a song called Second Line Girl. Tell us about them. Who are they?
Chawa is a band from New Orleans. And Chawa roughly translates to here we come, we're on our way, something along those lines. It's actually a slang phrase by the Mardi Gras Indians. And they're all about celebrating Mardi Gras street parade culture. And they're Grammy nominated and just always put out quality music that instantly transports you to the streets of New Orleans in the French Quarter.
Mm. Well, I definitely want to go there. So let's hear a little bit of Second Line Girl.
Second Line Girl. My world, light my fire. I just want you to be my.
head out the door. Gotta call my Gucci wine, gotta go to the store. You know just what to fight it, cause the barbecue smoke. Blue skies and sunshine, if you popping your nose. Then the second line start going up the street. Nonstop before I was knocking to that beat. And then I spotted you and you was looking at me. My soul left my body, couldn't move my feet.
I love this song, Aaron.
Right? It's so much fun,
oh
right?
Gosh.
You know, there's just something about the collection of drums with brass instruments that are just like, it's just so visceral. It just you know, it touches you in a way, in my opinion, much different and in a very unique way than the collection of any other composition of instruments and songs. You know, you think about when you hear marching bands, certainly this is in the same camp with the second line band. And yeah, it's just fun. Makes you feel good. I didn't even realize that it was sort of along this theme of being outside in summertime. So I guess it makes sense as well.
Yeah, it's speaking to you in that way. Well, tell us what the second line is for people who don't know.
The second line comes from a tradition in New Orleans where, you know, basically there were jazz musicians that would celebrate the dead at a funeral. It's sort of like New Orleans' version of Dia de los Muertos in a way. Mm-hmm. And essentially as the celebration would leave the funeral and spill out to the streets, the second line, as it's called, are the collection of people that would join in the celebration. So that's technically the second line.
Okay, so up next, a song called Clover. And what can you tell us about this song?
Clover, you know, I have been known to play and discover fairly obscure artists, and this is certainly one. The DJ producer's name is Juju. It's spelled D-J-U, D-J-U, which is actually Serbian, and it means I. I can't find that much information about him, but this is a fairly new song that he's come out with that I just really dig and enjoy.
Okay, here's Clover. Like you would hear this music when you're on a rooftop at a party, drinking, watching the sunset,
yeah.
And it's on in the background, and it's just setting
the mood. Absolutely,
the mood.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. I picked these songs some time ago, and I didn't even realize how appropriate it would be for the season and the sun coming out. And it's certainly one that falls right in line with the Chawa song. And maybe when it gets a little bit later in the summertime, that's when you're thrown in that Nala track.
Yeah, I know. We could have them all on just at our party that we're going to go to soon.
Let's do it. When's it happening?
Pretty soon, I think. I think it's going to happen soon.
Okay, I'll look out for the letter.
Okay, let's keep it going with EJ Warland. And I understand this new EP took 4 years for him to make. Is that right? 4 years?
That is, yeah. He's slowly but surely been trickling out a few of these singles over the last couple of years. And I don't think he's very well known, to be honest, but he certainly has been on my radar for the last couple of years. And I've been salivating, highly anticipating when the full project would come out. And it's finally out as of a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, so here is a little bit from his song, Hard to Find.
Devil came and sat on my shoulder. You fade if I give him time. He has no faith in what I've been given. But I do when it's now my time. Oh, I won't feel the change. No, I won't be out to blame. But I feel that I'm not, cause there's truth in my fight. I'm not gonna throw it all away.
Okay, this is a little different from the other songs that you picked.
It is a little
different. Why did you choose this one, and how did you find him?
Well, I chose it quite simply because it's a great song. How did I find him? If I recall correctly, a few years ago, a friend of mine, who is Todd Simon, And I think he actually composed the music for Left, Right, and Center. As a matter of fact, he's well known in the LA music scene. Yeah, and he passed it along to me. He knows my taste in music. And I play all kinds of stuff, and people say, what music do you play? I think it's probably maybe a bit easier to describe what I don't play. And so it's, though it's different from the first three tracks, it certainly falls in line with my type of programming and song selection for sure. And EJ Warland is just amazing. I mean, he's this Australian guy. I think he spends his time between Australia and Los Angeles, actually. And he's clearly a big fan of classic Americana music, as you can hear. And yeah, he just has a presence and a voice that that is just really appealing and attractive to me.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. All right. We have come to our last song, unfortunately. This is by an artist called Lineker. And who is Lineker?
Lineker is probably my favorite discovery over the last couple of years. She's actually a young trans woman from Sao Paulo, believe it or not. I think she's only maybe 24 years old. She's only been around for a couple of years. And I don't remember how she came across my radar, but as soon as you hear her voice, it's just instant magnetic feelings that that you have and you develop for this young lady. And she's just an incredible, incredible singer, songwriter. And she's quite the activist down in Brazil as well. And she's looked upon as being quite a symbol and obviously an advocate for trans rights. And yeah, she's just an incredible person.
Okay, so let's hear this song. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but it's spelled P-S-I-U.
It's pronounced Sue. It means psycho, as in American psycho.
Okay, here is Sue by Lineker.
Fazendo serenata.
Called Psycho, it's so pleasant to listen to because Portuguese is so beautiful.
Exactly. It's just a testament to how amazing of a language Portuguese is, right? And and maybe they make the cycles different down there below the equator, because this is such a beautiful, beautiful song.
So a lot of these musicians, they're new or they're unheralded in mainstream music. Is it important for you to discover and promote new artists on your show?
Absolutely. I mean, I think not just my show, but most of us as DJs at the station, we take that on as a responsibility that we're proud of as well. You know, every artist that you now know and that's really well known started off as someone unknown. So, you know, who knows who may transcend into the realm and stratosphere of popdom. But more than anything, I'm focused on playing good music. You know, if it feels good and it sounds good, that usually serves as my compass in terms of selecting what I'm going to play.
All right. Well, you certainly do. You have my endorsement, if that means anything to you.
Mama, I made it.
KZW DJ Aaron Bird, and you can hear him for 2 weeks at a time. He's on at night from 8 to 11 on weeknights, and he'll be on in 2 weeks from now. Travis Holcomb is doing the two-week stint now. Aaron, it's been so much fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
All right, that does it for us today on Press Play. Again, stay tuned at 1 o'clock. We'll have a live special from NPR where you will find out the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. That's expected to be read at 1:30. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.